This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Who pays for the wildfires? Maui's wildfire was among 28 disasters last year that each cost more than $1 billion. That's according to NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. State lawmakers are debating whether or not to allow Hawaiian Electric Company to recoup some of its costs related to the fires. No cause has yet been determined, and the first of a number of investigative reports that will be considered in the mounting lawsuits are expected this week. So will Hawaiian Electric customers be on the hook for wildfire costs? Mark Toney is the executive director of the Utility Reform Network. It's a California-based consumer advocacy group involved in one of the largest cases involving utility debt dating back to the 2017 California wildfires. Securitization is a fancy term for public financing of utility debt. Northern California Electric Utility PG&E took out $7.5 billion in ratepayer-backed bonds to refinance some of their debt tied to wildfire victims' claims. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote spoke to Toney about whether this move is good or bad for customers. He said it can be a good thing when done right.
Ratepayers end up spending a lot less money over time. Just think about the difference between the people who got their home loans at 3% or less and people today who are having to pay 7% or more. The same house, your payments are double what they are. So it's kind of like that. It's the same principle. Securitization actually was invented for the first time in the utility context when PG&E filed its first bankruptcy in the early 2000s. And it was a way that ratepayers would pay back a loan that had to be made because of market manipulation. This is Enron and a lot of those companies you might remember who artificially withheld energy so they could jack up the prices. And PG&E filed for bankruptcy then. And so what was on the bills for 20 years was something called the DWR, Department of Water Resources bond payment, that was on everybody's bills for about 20 years. And that paid for the excesses of the deregulation crisis. More recently in California, because of huge wildfires in 2017 and 2018 that PG&E was responsible for, they were authorized to borrow about $7.5 billion and to securitize that, which meant that they got public bond financing, ratepayers pay it back, but the shareholders are supposed to reimburse the ratepayers because state law doesn't allow a utility to make ratepayers pay for wildfires. That's the fault of the utilities.
So have PG&E customers seen a rate increase as a result of these ratepayer bonds?
There have been many reasons why monthly bills have skyrocketed for PG&E customers. It turns out that this securitization is not one of them, and that's because they were required to make sure that shareholders repay. So if you look on a PG&E bill and you open it up when it comes in the mail, you will see a line item that talks about the bond, repaying the bond as a bill, but there will be a bill credit for the exact same amount, which represents the shareholders reimbursing the ratepayers in real time. So there are many other reasons why the bills have skyrocketed, but in this case, securitization was not one of them. And it's pretty unique because the state law said, you know what? This is a shareholder responsibility. When a wildfire is started through negligence of the company, you cannot punish ratepayers You have to make it a shareholder responsibility. The same shareholders that reap the benefits of profits and earnings year after year after year, they got to pay when the chips are down.
If shareholders are still footing the bill, why go through securitization at all?
Well, look, this is a very specific case of a utility who has a real issue with cash and accessing cash and have limits to how much they can borrow that the lenders are willing to extend. So this particular case, it allowed them to access needed cash to pay wildfire victims, okay? We're talking about people who lost their homes, some of whom lost family members, lost their livelihoods in many cases. So these are legitimate claims that need to be taken care of. And at the same time, the utility in this particular case was simply not allowed for ratepayers to be charged. Now, there are a lot of securitization proposals in which ratepayers do pay, and those are worth it if it's less money than if the utility would have gone out and, say, for a capital project, had to pay 10% a year, collect 10% interest a year, instead of 4.5%, 5% interest a year. It is always better for anybody who's financing something over a long period of time to pay less interest rather than more interest. We're all looking for the best interest rate when we're trying to buy a car or buy a home.
Mark, given your work in utility financing, what do you think people in Hawaii need to know?
I think the most important thing is that ratepayers should never be on the hook for utility negligence. And if the utility is found negligent, and if they want to go through securitization to pay off their debt and use ratepayers, then there has to be a guarantee that shareholders reimburse the ratepayers in real time and not let anything get in the way of that in the future, so that it's an ironclad guarantee that ratepayers will be paid.
That was Mark Toney talking with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. He is with the California Advocacy Group, the Utility Reform Network, and was sharing its experience with the wildfires in that state. Hawaii lawmakers are headed to conference committees to consider legislation to allow Hawaiian Electric to use securitization to pay for some of its costs related to the Maui wildfires.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theater, reimagining homelands with Kenny Endo, Norman Kaneshiro, and Yuki Shiroma, retells ancestral memories April 20th and 21st, leeward.hawaii.edu/leewardtheater.
A recent nationwide survey on volunteerism put Utah at the top of the states. Hawaii isn't last, but tied for 45th place. But consider that the United Health Foundation's ranking in 2019 had Hawaii higher than the national average. Not anymore, according to the latest statistics. So can we get it back? Well, last year, Hawaii intentionally set April as Volunteer Month. Here to talk about opportunities to give back to your community is Kiona Kealoha, Executive Director of Kanu Hawaii.
You know, when we do look at some of those national numbers, we're not at the top of the list. But I also think that the idea of volunteerism is something that's kind of ingrained in us culturally, and it's local style, right? You share, you take care. There's not one person cleaning up at the end of the night. Everybody cleans up at the end of the night. It's just who we are, right? It's our style. So I think a lot of people are volunteering, but they probably wouldn't call it volunteering. They just call it being normal.
Okay. Well, we saw what happened with Maui and the outpouring of people that went in there and started doing things where they saw a need. They didn't wait for the infrastructure and the folks that normally come, because it took a while for, you know, some of these organizations to ramp up. But the community just went out there and did their thing.
Yeah, it's the same in every disaster, not just here either, everywhere, right? So usually what happens is the community reacts very quickly because they are the ones that are seeing their neighbors impacted themselves. Something has to happen. And there is a little bit of time that it takes for local government to react to that. The sooner it happens, the better, usually. But I think the best thing that we can do is that we can, instead of waiting for the next disaster, to start building some trust in our relationships between community, government, and different sectors that do come into play very heavily during a disaster response, is to do things when it's not a disaster, when it's a blue sky, right? So the idea of having Volunteer Month and celebrating that once a year in April, finding opportunities, connecting with people, having government officials and representatives and, you know, employees come out and participate and get to know some of the nonprofits that are on the ground doing work in their backyard.
You know, I don't know what impact the pandemic had on, you know, volunteerism. I mean, I know lots of events got canceled, and whether it's road races, you know, athletic events, you know, they're just starting to kind of get back to normal and they're out there seeking volunteers. But, you know, it is an adjustment.
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of an example, during the pandemic, when it hit, it was the middle of March, and we were a month away, 30 days away from hosting Volunteer Week that year. So we had a cancellation rate of about like 98% of the events canceled, right? And then we also onboarded like 120 new organizations and then helped to facilitate like tens of thousands of volunteer actions, you know, connecting them with these new organizations that were popping up in response to COVID. So, you know, the idea that this platform works in both cases is we've already seen it happen, literally. I think, you know, what we want to do is we want to, right now, especially this year is a good year, to get back out there and support some of our smaller and medium-sized nonprofits. Those are the ones that really took the hit. Larger organizations had more opportunities to come back. They have more established relationships with funding sources and things like that, right? But the smaller ones that are really holding the line on some of our very local places or some of our like very specific community places and people, Kapuna and students and mentor programs, things like that, those are the ones that really took the hit. So they're just kind of now getting back to a place of normalcy. So it did take them a couple of years, you know, kind of infusing some of these smaller organizations with your support and getting to know them and seeing how they, you know, are getting back on their feet, but also really fit in and contribute to the community. It's a great time to do that. And what we've done, you know, with our website or the platform is we've consolidated over 400 nonprofits, volunteer opportunities in one place. So it's very easy for you to search for things that are happening in Hawaii. And you can look, there's so many things. If you want to be outside, if you want to be inside, if you want to work with seniors, or there's just a multitude of different things that you could be doing.
You know, I know a friend of mine said for every walk or run or bike race or swim, for every couple that you do, pick one to volunteer on, which I thought was a great idea, you know. Or if you can, do both, right? You can do your Haliva metric ride, you can ride it and then also volunteer, maybe help clean up or break down. But, you know, those kinds of little things do it. But you do then connect with the community. And if you're an athlete, you know, it's your tribe, you know, you're helping them out, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about it. You know, I think a lot of our relationships are digital, or, you know, it's just the nature of where things are right now. But, you know, volunteering, there's always somebody that can use your help out there. And that's a lot of times what volunteers are doing. They're helping to support someone else or some other cause or a place that's special. And just getting out, you're going to naturally meet people you've never met before, but you share an interest, right? You share values around taking care of whatever that thing might be, or helping to support or preserve whatever that thing might be. And so you're meeting some like-minded people in a really great setting. Hopefully it's, you know, in person or outside, but it doesn't have to be, right? It could even be remote and it could be on your own time. So that's another part of volunteering, is it's not just going out and picking up trash and, you know, having all of our accountants and graphic designers picking up trash and doing manual labor, but why not in your own time give of your services, your professional skills in a way that really could support a nonprofit or local organization who otherwise would have to pay for that.
Right, pro bono, but boy, the give back is so tremendous. And then recently we featured tourists that were signing up to help volunteer while they were on vacation, which I think is an awesome way to get the connection, the real connection, so they see the real Hawaii and it's not just, you know, in a hotel and on a beach.
It's true. And unfortunately, there's not like a really, or hasn't been like a real go-to place for that, right, to really help facilitate opportunities for visitors. We just recently worked with HTA, the Hawaii Tourism Authority, to set up a subset of all of our organizations that are on our platform, on our website, to be posted up on the GoHawaii.com website and mobile app. And so those organizations have gone through an additional kind of level of rigor to meet a checklist that was produced by HTA to make sure that the organizations that are hosting events that are more visitor-facing or visitor-friendly are ones that have, you know, have considered first aid, they've considered safety measures. So, you know, just to make sure that we're recommending visitors to go to a certain kind of activity, that they're having a good experience, you know, generally speaking. A lot of times those opportunities end up being the ones that really define their vacation.
Yes. You know, I was at one event with the Limahui, and it was really nice to see the cultural information that they were passing on, you know, real authentic, just true experience here and learning about the environment. And it was really appreciated by the folks that were out there that were visitors.
Yeah. You know, there's the individual visitors, and if you look at some of the reports and the data that's coming out when we start looking, you know, the millennials have kind of taken over the travel segment. And then, you know, Gen Z and down the line, the kinds of experience they're looking for are not the typical corporate kind of type of activities. They're looking for things that are more connected to community. They want to give back. They want to have an authentic, like off the beaten path kind of experience when they're here. And so, you know, volunteering is one of those that allows for that. You're actually meeting real people in a way that they say is okay for you to come and participate. You're giving back. It's very culturally appropriate, right? You hana lima before you give before you ask, right? And so I think that it's a really, really great and kind of just at the beginning of being able to be opened up as a really good opportunity for visitors to Hawaii to connect with us, to connect with the people, and hopefully break down some of the stereotypes of how visitors are bad or they're, you know, we need to just redirect energy to places and in ways that are going to make sense for us here locally, you know?
Well, I know my mother always said growing up, you know, you leave a place better than when you found it, you know, whether you're just going somewhere to a beach or a park, but the same could be said for a visitor here, right? You come and you help the community.
Yeah, please. If you're going to come and you're going to help and you leave it better than you found it, then wouldn't people coming here kind of contribute more to Hawaii? So I think trying to think about that in systemic ways, how can we create campaigns or get a lot of organizations to kind of focus around some bigger metrics, some bigger impacts, and then help deliver that through marketing and other partnerships to visitors coming here. So they're literally coming here to participate in these bigger goals. That, you know, those could be many things, you know, but reconstituting our lo'i or our fish ponds and setting a goal of trying to support maybe 25 or 30 of those across the islands during a given month or a period of time. You can let your imagination run with it, but, you know, these are at the very beginning stages of big opportunities to make big change.
Big opportunities to make big change. That was Kiona Kealoha, Executive Director of Kanu Hawaii. And as he left our studios after that interview, he was headed to the Hawaii Food Bank to work with volunteers from United Airlines, one of the many partners working to make Hawaii a better place. Want to help? Well, check out volunteermonth.org to help out this month of April, or go to kanuhawaii.org to volunteer anytime.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's Beethoven Fest. Rapa Nui pianist Mahani Te Ave performs Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1. Dane Lam conducts April 21st at Hawaii Theater. MyHSO.org.
You know, this fall, a new charter school will open its doors. Kulia Academy will occupy space at the old St. John's the Baptist School in Kalihi. Its focus will be on science, technology, and math, with an emphasis on data science, artificial intelligence, and coding. We talked to Executive Director Andy Goche and Board Member Karen Awana about how the plan for this new school was hatched.
We've been at this for about 8 years, since 2016, looking at a charter school that would provide STEM, AI education for students, and particularly in areas where they may not have the exposure to have that type of curriculum in their school. So we work together and work very hard and very long to get our charter school application.
And so how did you folks, I guess, get, you know, the board together and just get enough like-minded people to launch something like this?
So through friends, we found each other. And then in our community, we found additional founding team members. And we had numerous meetings working on putting together an application. And we had numerous community meetings, getting input from our community members. And that shaped our charter proposal through the years.
So what's the plan for this fall?
The plan is to start with 100 students by the end of July and expand the following year with another 100 students coming into our sixth grade. So every year adding a grade level until it becomes a full middle and high school.
And so then how do you find the faculty to launch a school like this?
Well, the question on faculty, I would, you know, heed Andy's input because he is the executive director and he is hiring.
We have really high standards for our teachers because our curriculum demands a lot, not only from students, but also from teachers too, from administrators too. I've been a charter school administrator for about 20 years now. So I have a lot of connections. So we all use our connections to find teachers. For me, it's mostly STEM teachers, math, science, technology teachers. We also have professors of English and ESL on our board. So they help us also find high quality teachers for English language arts. We also advertise online platforms and we have been interviewing teachers. We have already secured most of our teachers, still interviewing a couple of more teachers.
And what's the focus on the grade level?
Starting with only sixth grade this coming school year, and then adding seventh grade, eighth grade, every year one grade level.
And so how does that work? Because AI is changing so fast. So, how do you keep abreast of the changes in technology?
First of all, it's been hard. We came up with the idea that data science and AI will be the rising careers of the future. And every single career, no matter what, psychology, law, whatever, you name it, they will require AI in the future. So we said we need to teach data science and AI. And I lived in Silicon Valley before. So I called my buddies at the high-tech companies, data scientists and AI engineers. I said, we would like to do this. And a couple of them said, it's not even easy to do it with undergrads. How are you going to do it in middle school? We said, we would like to do it. This is like, this is our mission. So we worked on it for about 6 months. Now we have a six-year curriculum from MIT, Stanford, UCLA, and some other private initiatives on data science and AI. But the question is, of course, it's an evolving field. So we already hired our data science and AI teacher in the beginning of January. And he's been working on updating our curriculum. And he was a data scientist before we hired him at UT Austin in Texas. So he came from a university data science background. He was doing data science and teaching AI at Johns Hopkins College, Johns Hopkins summer courses for high school students. So it's ingrained in our program that we will be updating our program, also with the help of professors from colleges through the years.
One of the biggest challenges that all charter schools face is facilities. Can you talk about the conversations the board members have had around that?
Sure. We have someone who is a member on our governing board, or initially on our governing board, who has a background in real estate, as well as some individuals in the community. They had made mention that there were some Catholic schools which were previously open that were closing due to the school closure. So we went ahead and we spoke with the diocese, a lot of negotiations, and initially at one site, and then finally at St. John the Baptist in Kalihi is the area that we were able to secure a venue, which is, I believe it's a very good move, because it has been a school before. They have the infrastructure in place. They have the elevators. They also have a science lab that's already been created. So it's almost like we're just moving into an area that was most recently not occupied.
Wow, so being able to secure a lease for the right. for the school.
Right, yeah, that's a big blessing. And I mean, it's a great facility. The science lab, the computer lab, the IT infrastructure is there. We are just upgrading. It's a great, great opportunity.
And the place where it is located, it's located right next to an elementary school.
Yeah.
So we've had discussions with the principal there in hopes that it could be a feeder for many sixth graders.
We were talking to Karen Owana and Andy Goche of the Kulia Academy, a new data science and AI charter school opening later this fall. We'll have a more of our conversation with them after a break.
Support for HPR comes from Magnolia Boutique and Gallery in Kahala Mall, featuring pop-ups with emerging artists Julia Sakamoto of Julia Yuka Studio and Momi Antonio of Swell Aloha, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., April 21st.
Let's continue our interview with Kalia Academy's Executive Director Andy Goche and Board Member Karen Owana. Kulia is a new charter school opening soon in Kalihi that will focus on data science, artificial intelligence, and coding. And so what do you say to people that are wondering, well, then what do you offer that maybe another charter school like the Myron B. Thompson, you know, School of Technology that they don't offer, you know, if you're talking STEM focus?
So every single school from now on will claim that they will be covering AI. Maybe not data science. Not most people know what data science is. But what usually happens is a guest speaker is called. They talk about AI and most of the time dangers of AI, how we should navigate. But in our case, we have an intensive six-year curriculum. Students have computer science classes every day. And they literally learn the algorithms, coding, planning, testing AI. And you might have heard Elon Musk was saying, I don't care about a college diploma or even a high school diploma. If you have the skills, I'm going to hire you. We care about the college diploma, but we would like to teach our students those skills. Some of our students might be able to secure jobs before even going to college, but we want them to go to college, of course. So this is an intensive six-year curriculum with the real data science algorithms, coding, all of those.
And are you hoping, you know, that there may be, say, students are being homeschooled, you know, that you offer then that little extra something that they just can't get at home because their parents aren't, you know, you know, down this path?
We are getting a lot of applications from homeschooled students too. In the future, we would like to share our program with other schools and open it to students homeschooled. In the current time, we are laser focused on having a stellar startup at the school. But also, we would like to offer adult classes too. AI might be a little bit too demanding, but there are some other computer science areas like quality assurance, cybersecurity, that through a 6-month or 8-month course, some community members might be able to secure IT jobs. So we are planning to add those gradually after our hopefully school opening.
And then anything else you want to add just about, you know, how people can get information and how to sign up?
Well, our applications will be always open.
Yes.
However, we will be starting up on our initial lottery on April 20th.
Yeah.
So you can go online, Facebook, on our website if you'd like to find out more information on Kulia Academy. And we'd also like to share that we've chosen that location because of the makeup of the community. We want to reach out to that community to share with them the opportunities that are available to them, to their families. We're also talking about having classes for families who may not have a computer, may not have a laptop, to help bridge those gaps between, you know, the parents who may be a first generation resident to the islands and their children who are learning these types of technologies.
Right, so we want to close that digital divide and the chasm, you know, between the haves and the have-nots.
Yes.
And get the generations together talking the same language.
So, yeah, as a charter school, we don't have attendance or residence boundaries. And we have been receiving applications from all over the island. Our lottery is on April 20th, but we continue receiving applications. At this moment, we are also receiving applications. We are accepting applications from fourth graders for not this coming school year, but the following school year. So if there are interested students, they can just go ahead and apply on our website, which is kuliaacademy.org.
And that was Andy Oche and Karen Awana, who are with the Kulia Academy. It's a new charter school planning to open its doors this fall. The window for applications is narrowing, though. A lottery for the 106 grade slots will take place April 20th. Officials say more than 100 families have already applied, thus the lottery. We will have a link on the conversation page of our website later today.